Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today, we're going to talk about who gets the house. The house is the biggest asset in any divorce, and we have the biggest expert in divorce real estate in Southern California. We have Michael Weinstein. Greetings, Michael.
Thank you. It's very, very exciting to be here.
So let me tell our listeners a little bit about who you are first, and then we're going to get to the questions. So Michael has the Weinstein Group, and that's who you would look for when you're looking for the best real estate person in a divorce. Michael is a recognized expert in divorce-based real estate sales across Southern California. Attorneys, mediators, and other legal professionals, like me, have come to rely on his knowledge regarding the handling of complex real estate matters during the course of a sale of a family residence during divorce. Using relationship building skills, and this is really important to Michael's success, using relationship building to produce the results needed in a divorce situation, family law attorneys and their clients find Michael's level of servicing to be imperative to success within their cases, because lawyers have to get people to decide on what to do with the family residence. Right, Michael?
Correct. Absolutely.
So Michael seeks to enhance the sales process with a series of systems designed to address clients' needs. And he's going to be talking about that within the course of the questions we're going to ask him. And lastly, Michael, of the Weinstein Group, is part of the board of directors for the California Association of Certified Family Law Specialists, which is a huge organization within the family law community. And so that's why we're especially lucky to have you today, Michael.
Well, I appreciate you for having me.
Okay, so let's educate everybody.
Sure.
Michael, what are the challenges in working with a divorcing couple in which the family home has to be sold? Go through those issues.
So one of the biggest challenges that we face is that a lot of the time the couples have opposing interests. So one party may feel the desire to keep the home or the other wants to sell it. One party may feel that the value is X and the other is Y. The motivations are most of the time very, very different. So that's a huge hurdle for us to overcome. There's a multitude of ways of doing that. It's just a matter of figuring out what fits in with their specific situation. And that's one of the things that I work on with them from the onset of dealing with their dissolution of assets.
So right. Give us an example.
So there's been I can give you a lot of examples.
Well, you played
with
mediator.
This.
You put on a mediator hat one day, you said, when you told me about a story.
100%. That happens quite frequently where I'm dealing with various issues. And I'll give you one example. I have a case, or I had a case a while back, where the husband was living in the property, not paying mortgage, not paying taxes, not paying anything. Wife was now living outside the property and was basically funding him staying in the property. So she was paying the mortgage, she was paying everything, he was paying nothing, but he refused to sign any documentation that we were putting in front of him pertaining to the sale. So we had to get the court in to essentially sign on behalf of husband to enable that contract to move forward so we could eventually get to the sale. And then he had to be evicted from the property.
And I want to get to that a little bit later, but there was another story that you told me that I thought was really cool. And by the way, Michael is not a mediator. I just said that he put his mediator hat on because all of us become mediators with different people at different points in time. But you were telling me a story about the house had to be sold, and the husband and wife were differing on what had to be done in order to get the house ready for sale.
Right.
Do you remember
right.
this?
Yes, I do remember okay. this one. So that is actually just kind of backtracking a little bit. That's actually one of the main issues we deal with as well, because some of the time, the house is not in the shape that we want it to be in to sell it, and maximize the price, which is what our job is as real estate agents, is to maximize the price of the home that we're selling. So there's a variety of options that we could bring to the table, one of which is a concierge program that we actually have that will front the money to pay for the renovations and improvements to the home at no interest and no fees to the sellers, so that way there's no risk involved for them. They basically, it gets dispersed in escrow.
Right.
So let's say you put in $10,000 into staging and painting and renovating the property. They don't even need to lift a finger in terms of money until the end of the sale. So an escrow gets dispersed back to us in terms of that payment. That's one of the ways of dealing with it. But in terms of that, that seems to be a major kind of, I would call a point of contention with people, is that one person may feel that improvements are needed and the other doesn't. So how do you get them to actually, you know, figure out what's best for the property? Sometimes is a bit of a challenge, and that brings on that whole mediator hat that you're talking about, is you know, how do we get them there? And there are ways of doing it. It would take me about an hour to get into all those details, but there are many ways that can be done.
When I sold one of my homes in Palm Springs, I lived there for a while. That's when I realized that if you don't have the money to refurbish the house, to give it the best price point, that the contractors, knowing that you're ready to put the house on sale, will then put a lien on the house.
They can, yeah.
I mean, it's not a horrible thing. Everybody's in agreement about
it.
Right. That then they will get their money out of escrow.
Yes, they can.
Yeah, and so this is an excellent thing for people to know, because sometimes you don't have the access to cash.
Right, right.
And you do need to do some major remodeling sometimes.
Sometimes it's substantial. I mean, we've gone as high as $40,000, $50,000 in renovations before putting a property out on the market. The only hurdle, and this is what people should understand, is that both parties need to agree to do it.
Yeah.
Whoever's on title need to understand that,
right,
that they both need to agree in order to make that happen. If one person doesn't agree with it, then it's impossible for us to do anything about it. So then we have to find alternative means to do whatever it is we need to do.
So it sounds like you are very creative in terms of addressing the needs of people. And you said there's a concierge group that you use.
Yeah, we actually have a concierge
internal
service
to your,
internal to our company. Yeah, so
phenomenal.
Internal to our company, where
phenomenal.
There's no fees, no interest.
Oh my gosh.
So literally it's like free money. And that is, we can use for whatever we need to use it for, whether it's staging or painting or even replacing the HVAC or replacing the roof, you name it, it doesn't really matter what it is. We have those funds, and it's all based on the equity that they have left in the property. So if there's limited equity, they may not be able to qualify for as much of a loan as if there was lots of equity in the property.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's all it's based on. And it's a very easy approval process. It takes 7 to 10 minutes.
Okay, so what Michael said was, if there's limited equity, which means there has to be money that you're going to make from
Correct.
Selling the house,
Correct.
Even with these improvements. So if you're upside down on a loan, you're not the right, this is not the right
it's
option.
It's not the right fit.
But if there's enough equity that both spouses are going to walk away with something decent,
yep.
especially if they can make the investment into refurbishing.
Absolutely. And it's substantially more. I mean, if you have a property worth $1 million and if you improved it by, let's say, $25,000-$30,000 in terms of doing renovations and staging and whatnot, and you sold it for $1.2 million, spending that $25,000 to make another $175,000 is a worthwhile investment. And that's what
yeah.
we try to do.
Oh, this is great.
So, yeah.
This is really great. This is wonderfully creative. Okay, here's another situation.
Mm-hmm.
When the lower wage earner, in a divorce, when the lower wage earner is the one who wants to stay in the house, and refinancing the mortgage is the only way to pay the other spouse their community property share, I know you're not a mortgage specialist, and I know you can only go so far into talking about mortgages,
mm-hmm.
but what are the options in obtaining mortgages? Do people actually have options?
They do. They absolutely do. The one hurdle that we overcome when it comes to one spouse wanting to take over the property is that the debt service kind of goes a little wonky when it becomes, it was two people and now it's one person who's on the mortgage. So what happens is, ultimately the one person can't afford it because their income is not high enough, and the numbers just don't make
sense.
Even
with spousal and child support.
Even with spousal and child. Especially in LA. I think that's more of an LA thing, or it's more of a big city issue because prices are so high. Right. So after you buy out the other spouse, you still have a giant mortgage that you need to be able to support with your income. And if your income is not as high as it needs to be to support that, that's where you have a problem. And sometimes the house simply just needs to be sold. But there are ways around it. I mean, there's FHA products and there's VA products, depending on your situation, that could help through that process. But ultimately speaking, your income is going to be a huge factor in terms of being able to support the mortgage on your own. And if you can't do it, there's also other things you can do, like guarantors and co-signers that could be an element we could bring in. But a lot of the time, they don't want to have third parties, you know, dealing with their mortgages and dealing with their homes. So it usually goes one way or the other. Either they can't afford it or they can't. And we try to help them out as much as they can. But you know, ultimately, it really depends on their income.
So I'm going to give you an example that I ran into in a mediation. And let's see how this works with you. So the wife was making about $5,000 a month gross. Mm-hmm. There was good equity in the house. The husband was willing to forego his equity in the house in exchange for not paying spousal support. And they were both on board with this. Okay. But then, of course, she had to go to the lender, the current lender on the house, and say, okay, so this is what I make. This is what I'm getting in child support. Talk back to me about whether I can refinance. And the mortgage company said, you still need more money than your income and child support in order to refinance. This is the number you need to get to.
Right.
And we need to see this amount of money coming in for X number of months or years. Is that how it works?
That is how it works. So the lender wants to see that you're going to be able to support this property or this mortgage even beyond your spousal and your child support needs or payments. Mm-hmm. So once that stops, if you can now not afford it anymore, the lender is at high risk. So the lender wants to buffer out that risk, and they buffer out that risk by making sure that the numbers at the onset of the mortgage make sense. And if they don't, then you come into more problems, which is why the majority of the time, the house ends up getting sold as opposed to being taken over by one spouse.
Because it's just it's a square peg in a round hole.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's just very little ways of really working those numbers because they are what they are. I mean, they're kind of concrete. So, and the lender is all about risk. Their whole business is about limiting risk. So if you're too risky for them, they simply just won't fund it.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So this all makes sense. And sometimes the reality is you just have to sell the house.
That's it.
Okay. So now I want to go to something you had mentioned in my as a response to my first question, which is selling the house by court order.
Mm-hmm.
So from the real estate side, you receive paperwork from the court that orders the house to be sold. And since I've never worked on your end, I've never seen what this looks like. I don't work with court orders. I have out-of-court amicable divorces.
Mm-hmm.
But I know two things. I know that in trials, the court can order the house to be sold, okay? And there's paperwork that the court issues for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also know there's a different type of divorce that I actually do, and that is when one spouse, normally the respondent, does not want to participate after being served, and there is a house that has to move. And quite often, and I'm obviously working with the petitioner, I will send the petitioner in on what we call a default hearing, and she or he will ask the judge to please order the house to be sold so that they can both get their equity share. Now, how does this happen without that other party participating, the party that didn't want to participate or is against the sale of the house? What do you do as the real estate company?
So I personally have never had a situation where you know, the husband or the wife didn't want to even participate in anything to do with it. But what I will tell you is I've had many situations where throughout the process, even though the court orders the sale because of, you know, various factors that are, you know, obviously pertaining to their divorce, where husband or wife decides that they don't want to sign any of the documentation and refuse to sign the listing agreement and refuse to sign counteroffers and refuse to literally do anything. So in a lot of those situations, what I would suggest to the and most of the time it's more in like the litigation matters.
And there's an attorney involved.
Yeah. So in a lot of those situations, I would go back and ask them to go in ex parte so that we can expedite the and ask the court to sign or the court clerk to sign on behalf of that party that refuses to sign. Once the court order is issued, we can do that. We have that power. So I go to the attorney and I say, can you go in ex parte, which is usually a 2-3 day thing. They'll go in, get the clerk to sign our documentation. And at that point, the court can actually sign the counteroffers, the court could sign the title documents, the court could sign virtually anything that is needed to sell that house. If the one party, the one spouse, decides to stay in the property regardless of it being sold, right, legally, like lawfully by the court, we now have to get into a more of an unlawful detainer action, which removes him from the property. And that becomes a very messy situation, but it does happen. Right?
Have you experienced
it? I have experienced it many times where we actually literally have to go in and do a UD action to remove that spouse from the property.
UD meaning unlawful detainer.
Unlawful detainer, yeah, exactly. So the sheriff goes in after the notices are served, the sheriff will go in and literally remove that spouse from the property.
The human being from the house?
The human being and all the belongings, yeah. Yeah.
No kidding.
It does happen. It's not a common issue because normally they resolve it. It's very uncomfortable, especially considering he was at one point the owner of the home. But now the court has superseded that, and now they're basically saying you need to leave. And he says, no, we need to step up that game and get him to understand that the court's word is final and there's reason behind it. And that's where we get into all these processes in terms of getting court to sign for him, then removing him from the home if he refuses to leave, which most of the time, luckily enough, they leave. So it's not that big of a deal.
Because they see the fait accompli.
It's just it is what it is.
It's going to be what it's going to be.
Please take the check.
You have money coming.
Correct.
And you have to go now.
Correct. Rather than getting out by force, they're getting out, you know, within their own, you know, they're just walking out the door and they're good to go.
So because I have been a former homeowner a few times, mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of paperwork involved mm-hmm. with the sale of a house. So each time you need that non-compliant spouse's signature, mm-hmm. do you have to keep going back to court with
yes.
all the new? Because all the paperwork can't be generated at one time.
Every document, every disclosure, and every document. So all of the transfer disclosure statements, the seller property questionnaire, everything we normally would have to do with both sellers before the sale, the transfer takes place, because that's state law, that all has to be signed by the court. So literally, there's an exempt seller disclosure that would have to be signed because the court has never lived in the property. Obviously, they don't know about leaks and issues that you've had or all that stuff. So the court has to sign an exempt seller disclosure to allow for that transfer, stating basically they have no idea about what's going on with the property, and the buyer is to do their own due diligence to figure out if there's any issues that would bother them when it comes to the sale. So the court has to sign all of these things, and that's sometimes the only way of doing it.
Michael, you don't go to court with them. They have to have an attorney they're working with. How does this work?
I have been to court. So yeah. I have been to court. Sometimes we do have to testify as to what transpired throughout a case. And I have been to court on these matters. It's not a typical thing. It never goes that far for the most part. But it is something that we have to do occasionally.
So, but should people have an attorney with them, like the person who wants to comply and get the house sold? Or what do you think the best course is?
Well, having an attorney is not always necessary. It really all depends on the mindset of the people that we're dealing with. So if they feel that they're amicable enough that they can go in and make sound decisions without the help of an attorney and the law behind them.
We're talking about the situation where only one person wants the house sold and we have a non-compliant spouse.
Well, then I think attorneys might be something to look into. Because
For the
compliance part of it. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, for the compliance spouse.
Right.
So having a little bit more of a legal backing and doing things as per the legal processes, you should have an attorney to kind of back you up on that.
Do you think it should be a real estate attorney or a family law
attorney? A family law attorney. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You should have a family. Unless you go by means of needing to do an unlawful detainer, which we talked about,
right.
That would be a real estate attorney. A family law attorney, don't get involved in that. So, okay. But for the compliance of, you know, the matter we're dealing with, then a family law attorney would definitely be the best person for doing that.
Fascinating. This is something I've not dealt with, and I've always wanted to know how it works.
It's sometimes a struggle, but we have various means of eliminating a lot of that struggle.
Do you get nervous during these transactions?
No, I mean, there's one thing that I personally do that I think has really helped. I have an addendum that I add on to every listing agreement when it comes down to any divorce situation. And that addendum is standard in terms of the it sets out the rules of the transaction for both parties. So, for example, if one spouse doesn't really want to sell and the other does, but they've decided they're just going to do it and see how it goes, the addendum basically sets out showing times, it sets out showing days, it sets out what they need to comply with, it sets out what we're going to do with the property prior to listing, the fact that before showings, the property needs to be in good condition and cleaned. It sets out every parameter that they need. So I incorporate that into my listing agreement, which kind of acts as another legal contract between the parties. Probably 7 times out of 10, I get a little bit of pushback from the attorneys if there are attorneys involved. But at the end of the day, they realize that it is something that's warranted and they end up going through with it. And that addendum has been written by me as well as attorneys that I have done a lot of work with. So it's been going on for years. I mean, I've been doing this for years.
So you like working with divorcing couples. You consider it a challenge, don't you?
It's an area of real estate that I think is underserviced because most people are in the industry are very transactional. And that's one thing that people should know is when you're hiring someone as a real estate agent for a divorce circumstance, the person should be non-transactional, meaning they need to be able to look within what's going on within the parties as opposed to we're just trying to list and sell the home. Because there's so many nuances throughout that process that if they don't do it correctly, they're literally just raising more barriers and putting more hurdles in front of the parties instead of lowering those barriers and hurdles. So that's why it's important that the people that are involved in that be the right people. So it doesn't necessarily have to be me per se. There are other people who deal in divorce, but they should have some sort of specialty in this divorce world in order to be able to handle it properly.
How did you get interested in this? Working with divorcing couples.
So I've historically been a non-transactional sort of real estate agent, even, you know, before getting into the world of divorce. But I actually am married to a divorce attorney who's actually a mediator. She has her own practice. And our whole lives revolve around this stuff. So it became very interesting to me about 13 years ago to see the fire sale kind of techniques that agents were doing when it came to the properties sold in divorce. They would literally tell the buyer's agents that this is a divorce, bring whatever offer you can, they got to sell it. And I kept seeing that over and over again. So I wanted to change that whole dialogue when it came to the sale of property in divorce, which is why I got into this area and educated myself about the various issues surrounding it. And I kind of honed the way that I do things and created these processes so that, you know, people like yourself who are in mediation or litigators could actually leverage that for their cases so they can get through some of the hurdles that normally they would have when it came to selling property. They'd basically be able to eliminate those.
So that's so fascinating because certainly it didn't occur to me that possible contentious nature of divorce, and even if you think it's amicable, once you're faced with decisions as a married, soon to be unmarried couple, you go back into your contentious mode naturally,
right?
Because that's how you have been taught.
That's how you're taught.
And
right.
So, yes, it will come up then when the marital settlement agreement has already been written and the decision is to sell the home. That's fine. Now, once the divorce is over, you actually have to do it.
Yep.
And you're back into the same dynamic that you were as a couple that led you to divorce.
Yep. That's exactly what happens. And a lot of the time you'll actually see them divert even further back to, you know, hey, our house is on the market, but now I want to keep the plates and the cutlery. And, you know, you said you wanted that. So I'm going to literally create roadblocks pertaining to the sale so that I can leverage that in our court case so I can keep the cutlery and keep all that stuff. And it just, it creates these hurdles along the way. It's that mental mindset that people have, right? They just can't release the idea that this property needs to be sold so that both parties could have some finality. They want to keep it going.
And what's the best way to expedite? Instead of going that way, they get back into whatever it was that fueled
the original thing. Exactly. That's what I was getting at. It's kind of like the original fuel to the fire. They kind of stick to that instead of continuing to move it forward so that they can actually end this whole thing. And that's one of the big hurdles that I think everybody kind of faces. It's like, you know, the idea is to get to finality. The idea is not to take a 3 or 4 year marriage and have it go through all these hurdles
for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years of selling the house, or 3 or 4 years of mediation or of litigating.
Right.
You know, the idea is to get to finality, and the finality is usually, you know, you get there by you know, following the right path instead of creating more roadblocks and barriers.
Okay, so I just started thinking about something. When I write in the marital settlement agreements about the house, mm-hmm. I'm very detailed oriented, and the devil is in the details.
Right.
You know, logistics are very important to me because it's great. Okay, we're going to sell the house and we're going to divide the equity. Well, when? You know, that's one big logistical question. When?
Mm-hmm.
And so I go through that with people. I said, let's put as much detail as possible in here so there are no unknowns
right.
once the divorce is final. Have anybody shown you their marital settlement agreements
yes.
that detail how
yes.
they decide? Oh, good.
Absolutely. I actually help a lot of the attorneys and mediators. I help draft the judgments so that I get to see exactly what's going on within their divorce, because it helps me create their process a little bit better. So yeah, there's a lot of things that when it comes down to it is I get all that documentation ahead of time so that I see, you know, what has been agreed to already or what the court has stated needs to happen. And that literally helps with our process. And a lot of the time I actually helped to, like I said, I actually helped to write a part of the judgment stating that this is what's going to happen. And this is how it's going to happen. And that way, at least there's a roadmap, is what we're talking about, is to get into that finality that's so important.
Okay, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
This is really beautiful. I loved hearing this. Lastly, for my questions, it's agreed upon that one person will stay in the house and keep the house. The other person will leave. And at some point in time, they will get paid their equity share.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a situation where the person staying in the house can't afford it. They
mm-hmm.
can, but they can't afford the refinancing of the mortgage to take the leaving spouse's name off the mortgage.
Right.
So it'll just be a mortgage in one person's name, which means there's an obligation in one person's name as opposed to an obligation in both parties' names.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I do, and you can counsel me. I can't force anything, obviously. I'm just a mediator and a legal document assistant. But I say, as a person who's owned several properties, do you understand the difference between leaving title and leaving mortgage? And if it's a first home for people, no, they have no idea.
Right.
When you go to buy a home, the mortgage and the title are presented at the same time at the escrow meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in a divorce situation, when the home's not being sold, leaving title doesn't mean your name is being removed from the mortgage, right?
Right, right. Absolutely. There's a huge difference. And some situations involve spouse, let's say spouse A, staying on mortgage while removing himself from or herself from title. And really his liability remains for both elements still, because if let's say they default on mortgage and he's just on the mortgage, that could send the house into foreclosure, which he's still party to.
Oh my
right?
gosh, I never thought about this,
right.
which would diminish and take away that asset value that was going to be assigned to the leaving spouse.
Right, because then you're looking at huge fees and costs and time and legal issues. So all of a sudden, you're eroding equity from the home if that were to happen. And the responsibility of being on mortgage, even though technically speaking, it's just the mortgage, not title, they relate to one another. So there will be an impact on the home if he or she decides to default on mortgage. So there is massive liability when it comes to doing that, regardless of what anybody says about like, oh, he's just on the mortgage or she's just on the mortgage. That still has liability on the actual home itself if they default, especially if they default.
Okay, I really hadn't thought about this. What I wanted to talk about was, and this now this is a little bit of a larger conversation, and this is in the best interest of just real estate mm-hmm. execution. So what I say to people is, it is certainly up to you what you do, but if you leave title, leaving spouse, before you're able to leave mortgage and spouse living in the house dies, and there's no will, there's nothing that gives you that asset value, or you are obligated to pay the mortgage. If there's mm-hmm. still a mortgage, you're obligated to still pay the mortgage
you're
on the mortgage.
Correct.
And if you're off title, you've just taken your name away from that asset.
Right. So how do you deal with the house if you're now off title but you're on mortgage? So that's where it becomes a bit of a convoluted situation. So I generally speaking, I don't tell people that it's the right thing to do unless they're willing to take on that liability. That's all it is. It's like you have to be willing to take on that liability in case something happens to spouse A who's on title,
can't
they
work.
Die.
You know,
it can't
innocently
work.
Has an accident.
That's
can't
right.
Can't work.
Anything.
Doesn't have disability insurance. So
yep.
If you're on the mortgage and you're still waiting for your equity share, you
right.
may have to jump in and pay the mortgage, but you still have... Well, you have the asset assigned to you in the settlement agreement. You have that.
So what about, let's dig a little bit into this, but what about in areas like in Los Angeles where we're prone to earthquakes? So most people don't have earthquake insurance, right?
Uh-huh.
So if you don't have earthquake insurance and all of a sudden another Northridge happens, then house falls apart. You know, you no longer have asset. You no longer have, and insurance will cover a part of it, but sometimes not all of it. What happens at that point? Mortgage is not going away, right? So you have the liability of so many different areas when you just remain on the mortgage and not on title, because then you're not entitled to anything pertaining to the house other than responsibility for the mortgage. So it gets very, very tricky, especially in areas like Los Angeles or San Francisco or areas like that.
So is this one of these, it's best to sell the house if you can't refinance?
In most situations, especially when people are looking at finality, they should consider selling. And I'm not saying that as a real estate agent. I'm saying that for their own kind
of... For these examples that you just gave I hadn't thought about.
Yeah, these examples are just you know, opening up the sort of can of worms that could happen.
But you should think about them. You have to
absolutely.
Think about them.
Absolutely.
We have fires, floods, and earthquakes
absolutely.
Now.
It should be either a clean buyout where spouse A is off the title and is off the mortgage and it goes to spouse B, or it should be a sale of the home. Even though you can do other things, the liability doing it is just far too high, in my opinion. So that's what I explain to a lot of my people. Obviously, there's estate planning issues as well. There's taxation issues. There's all kinds of different issues. But for the most part, it should be a clean one way or the other, and just to avoid future issues. So that's always been my opinion.
This is powerful information. The very last question I wanted to ask you about this, and I honestly know you're not in mortgage, you can't really speak for mortgage companies, but you at least interface with them as a real estate agent. And so this is something that I have had to accept sometimes from attorneys who are counseling my clients, because you should have somebody in your back pocket just to use for
sure.
general counsel.
Sure.
Don't have to keep them on retainer,
mm-hmm.
but your go-to attorney if you need help
mm-hmm.
On an hourly basis. So we're in this situation again where spouse A is leaving and for some odd reason wants to leave title
right.
and still has to remain on the mortgage. And I will get language from the attorneys that say, Judy, don't worry about it. I've got this. We're going to put language in the settlement agreement that says if party B, who stays in the house, defaults, party A will not have to be responsible for the mortgage. And I'm like, did you call the mortgage company?
Yeah.
Have you counseled? No, it doesn't matter. And then I went to a seminar that a judge was teaching, and a judge said, stop that, attorneys.
Yeah.
Now, from your seat in the real estate business, are you as an agent, or do you think a mortgage company would be obligated to language like that?
Absolutely not. The mortgage company, their documentation and their contracts are very straightforward. They want as much responsibility on the parties as possible. So they're not going to be amenable to doing that type of thing. But it's always important for the lawyer or mediator to phone them ahead of time before even injecting that into as an option.
Them meaning the mortgage, the lenders?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Phone the lender before Smart. Making those decisions. Make sure that particular lender is okay with it, which most of the time they will not be, right? There are a couple of options that are very, very rare, and that is with hard money lenders, because they look at the deal very differently. They look at the situation very differently.
What's a hard money lender?
A hard money lender is someone who's typically lending at a much higher interest rate and basing it on the equity in the home. They're not necessarily looking at it from a debt service issue or other things that a regular lender will be looking at when it comes to your qualification for a mortgage. They're looking at the home itself, what it's worth, and what you want to, what they're going to lend on. Usually it's up to 65 or 70% of the home's value, but they're charging 9 or 10 or 11%, right? Mm-hmm. And there's fees involved, and there's a lot more involved in that. They're not going to be as, let's call it, overly critical of small things as a regular conventional lender would be. So that may be an alternative if there's a dire situation that someone wants to deal in a situation like what we're talking about right now. 9 times out of 10, or I would even say 9.9 times out of 10, the answer will be no, they're not willing to deal with it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
It makes sense because you're now involving the financial business of somebody that's never had a conversation.
That's right. That's right. They're like a third party that's never been involved.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like making grandma the new mom of the kids without asking grandma if she wants
to. You just ship them off to grandma and away you go. Right. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, which is why, you know, the most straightforward path or the most straight path to all this is just keeping it straight, basically.
Either sell the house or refinance it now.
Right.
As part of the divorce.
Right.
So that you can cleanly leave title and mortgage. You
right.
pick up your check from the escrow company and the refinance. We're all happy.
And that's it. And the spouse that's buying out the other does have options in terms of financial support. They can have a guarantor that would help them, you know, fund those mortgage payments and create security for the lender. So when the lender feels secure and low risk, because let's say the parent of spouse B is now, you know, who's got a couple million dollars in assets, is now guaranteeing the loan, everything could be all good. But, you know, the parent or whoever it is as guarantor needs to be able to or want to step up and actually do that, which sometimes is a little bit difficult and sometimes it works. Like sometimes you have a parent who's like, I'm gonna help my daughter out, I'm gonna help my son out.
Exactly.
So they have to look at those options as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, Michael, because of your vast experience dealing with divorcing couples, what is your best advice to divorcing homeowners so that they can make the best out of court decisions to cooperatively sell the house?
That's a fairly simple answer. Try to get on the same page with everything. Understand that, you know, a divorce, although it is deemed as being a negative thing, sometimes is better for the two parties. And because the home sometimes is the biggest asset that they own, it tends to interfere or create a bit of fogginess in terms of their decision making when it comes to getting rid of that asset. So just keep in mind that you're both trying to get to the end of this, And by selling the home, sometimes that really, really, really helps. Because when you sell your biggest asset, you now have that like openness to like move forward and deal with other more important situations like children and everything else that you're dealing with.
Is this how you talk to people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I get into a lot of situations where it's going through litigation. And when you go through litigation, they're sometimes fighting about literally everything in the world.
The toasters.
Everything. Literally, you name it, whether it's like, you know, stick figures that they had from when they were kids and they brought them into the marriage and they're fighting over who's, you know, the value has gone up since then and they're trying to fight over those. Sometimes they just need to forget about all that. Those are just like little, you know, kind of like monetary things, you know, things that are just, they're just things, they're just items. Their main goal is get to finality. And when they get to the end of the process, they can now release it from their life and move forward. And that's what I always try to teach people when it comes down to dealing with the home is like, don't make this a big thing. You know, it's a molehill that you're turning into a mountain. So let's try not to turn it into a mountain. Let's try to just get through it. And then it's done. And then you don't worry about it.
I've loved every single thing you said. The time has gone like 5 minutes. I can't believe it. And I've learned more than I knew. And I thought I knew a lot about real estate. This has been absolutely wonderful.
I appreciate it. And we've just scratched the surface. So
dang.
It's good.
Yeah. Okay. So I want people to get in touch with you. Please say how they can.
Anyone can get in touch with me for more information if they need a consult or if they need, you know, advice on what to do with the house. You can reach me at 310-569-2043 is my phone number.
Say it again.
310-569-2043. And my email address is michael@winestonegroup.com. And I'm available at all times.
Say
and
again.
That's michael@winestonegroup.com.
Winestone is Winestone.
You got it. Just how it sounds. Just how it sounds. Yes.
This was an absolute pleasure. Would you come back?
Absolutely.
I'd love to have you.
Anytime. Back. Thanks for having me.
So you have been listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host, amicable divorce expert, self-proclaimed. And you can reach me at this address, Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy@constructiveuncoupling.com. But if you are in the Southern California area and you would like to get in touch with me otherwise for mediation or divorce, my company is divorceresourceinc.com. Divorceresourceinc.com. I appreciate all of you who are listening, and I'll talk to you next week.